Welcome, everyone. This is Gary Carpenter with Prepare for College. And again, that website is prepare4college.com. And please take a minute and just look at the website and start to go through some of these podcasts. I think you're going to find something that's very interesting for you. Today, we're going to talk about assets on the FAFSA form, primarily investments. Last week, as you know, we did assets on the FAFSA form, cash. This week, it's investments. Next week, we're going to do assets of the business. We've got Al Hoffman here again doing the presentation. So I'm not going to bore you with a whole bunch of baloney. I'm going to just pass you right over to Al. Al, on to you.
Okay, so whoever has the jokesters out there, help me out, because this is probably the most boring part of the FAFSA, is to go through the list of investments. Don't hesitate, either one of you, to try to put a little bit of levity into this. But as we list this, families, understand that this is a section where you count all the assets, maybe on a separate piece of paper or an Excel spreadsheet, however, whatever your choice is. And then at the bottom, you count it all together, and that one figure is what's going to go into the question that revolves around assets, investments. It actually says assets, current network of investments, including real estate. We'll spend a little bit of time on that real estate one. That gets a little tricky. All right. So let's list these assets. Well, the first one is real estate, of course. So real estate is property, of course, that you may own. You don't include the home in which you live in. Now, other documents like the profile does, but the FAFSA does not. Do not. And it's in bold print. And every year we run into somebody that decided to list that. No, no, no. Do not list your home. It is not in that property. Now, if you have a second property, then it's going to be the value of that minus the debt, and you come up with an equity figure. That's what you're going to put on your Excel spreadsheet, equity and property number one, two, number three. And you say, well, wait a minute, this is a business. But we'll get to that next week. And the kind of carries over. This is kind of a crossover on, because it could be either here in the investments or it could be in the business side. It all depends on how you're doing things. We'll talk about that next week.
Yeah, but for this week, jump in here with a little accountant humor, so to speak.
Yeah, absolute. Go ahead. Oh, there is such thing. Okay, let's get
loud. There is. Okay. If you have a second home, second property, it's got debt on it, okay? Or it does not have debt on it. Some things you may want to look at is possibly going out and getting debt on that second home so it reduces the value of the asset.
Mm-hmm.
And then taking that cash that you've got, because cash is assessed, and use it to pay down the mortgage on your primary residence. It's just a tip there, something you may want to look at.
Oh, I like it. Yeah, I like it. That's fantastic.
Think about it. So
let's
much
run it up. Yeah. Well, and here's another thing. And this happened during the COVID situation and back in 2008 as well. But some people got reversed. I mean, their market value was, you know, 200,000 and their debt was 400,000. So there was no equity and it was a minus equity. Well, the rules in the FAFSA don't allow you to count that in the way that you're thinking. In other words, if you had three properties, one was underwater and one was maybe had $10,000 worth of equity, then the blank on the underwater goes to zero. It doesn't negate the 10,000. It's not a cumulative value. In a business, that's different. But in this particular section, in the asset section, it is, you have to count it each property. And if it's negative, it's a zero. And then the second property, and then the third property, and then the fourth property. You each treat them separately. Okay, so it gets a little tricky, and the directions, by the way, are not very clear on that. But that is legally how accurately how it's done real estate. Okay, so let's go on. So obviously, a vacation home is listed in the list of assets, but it really is a second home, don't you know? So it's treated the same way. The market value minus the debt equals the equity. And now that's the second item in your little Excel spreadsheet as you create this cumulative total. And then there's CDs, certificates of deposit. This is not too hard to understand. I mean, obviously, the title pretty much says it on whatever you have in there. But it is an issue of, as far as the value of that CD. Okay, the value of that CD. So it is their accountant. Do we take the value of where it's going to be, or do we do the value of what we put into it when we created it? There are going to be different takes on this. Lump sum for the fixed period of time is what a CD is all about, but it's going to be worth more when you cash in your redeem your CD. You receive the money you originally invested plus interest. So how do you get what it is today? Because you have to fill out the FAFSA as your assets are today. So this is where you would go back to your bank or whoever you acquired your CD from, find out what the current value of that CD is. That would be more accurate. Maybe an ultra conservative would be the initial value, and an ultra liberal would be the value that it would be in when it matures. But for right now, I think the more accurate way is to go to the institution you got the CD from and have them tell you what it is worth today.
Al, I'm going to jump in here with some other side of the table discussion here on the CD. I've seen situations where CDs have been purchased and all of a sudden something comes up, an emergency, whatever, and they have to cash those CDs in. And as soon as you cash those CDs in, there's a penalty that's involved. So I always go from the standpoint of, and this is pushing the envelope, I go from the standpoint of how much did you invest? Okay. Take whatever the normal interest rate in the savings account is today and apply that to whether it's a 6 months, 12 months, whatever it is, CD. Those two numbers are what you use. Now, when the CD matures, it may be higher than that because you've had a higher interest rate. But we don't know what's going to happen between now when we buy the CD and when it's cashed in the future. So from that situation, I look at the value of the CD plus the regular savings account, which is going to be, half a percent if that. And that's what I use when I calculate the value of a CD. Just a thought.
I like it. No, I think it's a good point. And again, there is an honor system. There is no backup colleges asking for statements. This is something that you have to put down as an on an honor system. There is no verification of these numbers. So it does leave it for a little bit of a different interpretations as you go. Or the next one is kind of interesting. Commodities. Oh my goodness. It's not listed in the digital FAFSA, but it is listed in the paper FAFSA. Well, it's commodities, okay, gold, whatever, those things that are making other products would be a commodity. The institution that you get a commodity from, again, will tell you what it's going to be worth as a current statement for today. Kind of an odd one, though. It is there, obviously. I'm not sure why it's not listed in the digital FAFSA, but it is listed in the issues of investments. Money markets. Also, pretty easy. The money market goes in, money market goes out. Call your institution for the value of it as of today. Any input on that one, Gary?
Money markets are pretty straightforward. I mean, they're going to be paying, they call it a dividend or an interest on that, and they're going to be paying it on a monthly basis. So, what I usually try to do is, let's say we're doing a FAFSA today, and this is middle of May, okay? And we have a report from April. I'm going to look at what we had in April, and I'm going to say, okay, what happened between April 30th in the middle of May. Do you still have the commodity or the fund
Money market.
money? Thank you. And they obviously they're going to have it, but sometimes you have people that might have just, well, I have this money market, but oh, by the way, I sold it last week. It's gone. Okay. So you want to take a close look at that to see if it's still there. And then I like to use the end of the month numbers from a statement because that's easiest to justify than to go into a lot of computations to say, okay, the value is this on May 13th. So just a side
Same
eye.
thing. Yeah, same thing. Chuck, I know you created a whole financial literacy course, a beautiful course, actually. And a little plug here for you. But at the same time, the next one is very similar to the money market, because that's bonds. Going to get that statement as far as that value is, and pick the most recent statement that's closest to where you are at the date that you're filing the FAFSA. So start.
One of the
Yeah, go ahead.
things on the bond investment that a lot of people may be overlooking, how do you assess the actual value of a bond? Well, the way you assess the value of a bond is very similar to a certificate of deposit. You're loaning money out for them to go out and purchase, whether or not they're government securities or corporate bonds or community bonds. And what I normally tell a lot of individuals when they're dealing with the value of the bonds come out very similar to CDs. They will have a set interest rate. Now, let's assume that interest rate was 2.5%. That would be the value or the interest you would get from the bonds. But now let's say interest rates have gone up, let's say to 4.5%. So really, what is your true value of your bond? The bond basically would be less, the bond value would be less than what the current bonds are out there on the market. So therefore, you would get a capital loss on that because you wouldn't be able to sell those bonds for their actual true value because the interest rates, no one's wanting to buy them. Now, just in reverse, if your bonds were paying 5.5% and the current interest rates on this current same type bond is 2.5%, then you've got a premium on those bonds. So therefore, the bonds are going to be worth more if you were to cash them in. So I normally tell a lot of individuals, take that in consideration when valuing of the bonds instead of actually taking what your account value is on your last monthly statement or whatever. Look at the actual value if you were to cash that bond in, whether or not you would have a capital loss or a capital gain.
Good point. Good point. All right, next up on our hit parade of assets to be listed in the FAFSA is stocks. And right off the bat, this is an area that is a lot of mistakes are made because the people may have stocks and other of these things that we've already issued in a tax deferred account, an IRA or something of this nature. So you don't count assets in tax deferred accounts. There is a couple of exceptions we're going to hit here shortly. 529 is a tax deferred, but that's counted. But stocks is not counted if it's in a tax deferred account. Now, stocks again, what are they worth today? Again, it all depends on the where you are on that market. And again, those are statements is going to be probably the closest thing that you can come to couldn't to come to an accurate value on the stock. But again, do not count it if it's in a tax deferred account like an IRA. Okay.
Al, could I jump in here real quick?
Absolutely.
And I'm an accountant, so I'm picking the things. But if you have your own business and you own stock in it, we're going to be talking about that next week. So anyone out there that has stock, but it's stock in a closely held organization, it's not public, we'll be talking about that next week. Just wanted to jump in there.
You know, and the one-liner for that is don't double count. There's an issue here. We have three things that kind of cumulatively calculate in the FAFSA as an asset. in, again, the cash investments in business. So whatever you are, you don't double count them. If they're going to be in one area, they're not in another. The next up is mutual funds. Very similar, again, can be in tax-deferred accounts. So don't count them if they're there. Outside of that, pretty much the same as the stocks. Get that statement. Pretty much the only way to get a value right now. And then the next one is the one that really gets up a lot of action, and that's the 529 plan. There are a couple of different educational savings accounts or educational qualified educational benefits, and that would be the Coverdell account and the 529 account. The 529 has two types, and that's the college savings and the prepaid tuition are both counted the same. So let's talk about this a tiny bit. On 529s, there is a beneficiary and there is an owner. The beneficiary is, let's say, the student, and the owner, let's say, is the parents. The 529, you would think, logically, beneficiary, it must be a student asset, right? Wrong. It is a parent asset that's specifically been put in the law as a parent asset. So it's going to count on the parent side. Well, how about that grandparent that has that 529 owner, 529 beneficiary, student? Does that count? No, it doesn't. It is accounted, now if the student has it and they're independent, then of course it counts. But it is, it's a parent asset. That's the part that really needs to be brought up, is that it is a parent asset. Okay, so then one more thing to talk about. Okay, grandparent, alive and kicking, owner of that 529, and you gave 20 grand to little Johnny for his first year of college. So does that count anywhere? Okay, so you're going to get different opinions on this one. We might get that today. Not sure. We're about to find out. But 529 is that goes into that student, in other words, goes straight to the college for the student, then it is not counted as an asset on the 529 for the parent or for the student. It's going to be just money that comes to the college through the 529 plan. Are those that would say, well, that means it's going to be an asset or an income issue next year? Well, the asset, maybe. Income, no. That used to be the old rule. The 529, when exercised by a grandparent for the benefit of the student. I know I'm boring you all. This is kind of technical in the weeds here, but then it would be a situation where it would be an income to the student in the following year's tax FAFSA. That's not the case anymore. So it's pretty much the benefit of the student is very, very much in totally cool thing is the 529. I'm not a particularly big fan of 529s, but with these new rule changes, it does make them look more attractive as far as portfolioing, making a portfolio of opportunities for your paying for college. So 529. Now, are there those that would say that grandparent uses that 529 and would be an asset in the following year's FAFSA? And I would disagree slightly with that because it's not, remember, assets are at time of signing. And at time of signing, even though it has not ever been counted in any kind of formula yet, it is not there. Probably better if the grandparent would be to say, let's give that 529 monies to the parents to then pay for the college. So another way to keep things kind of out of the formula in some respects, these are not illegal things. They're just different things that are variables of this 529 issue. Gosh, I know I've got some input here from my accountant and financial planner people. So
Yeah, so one of the
yeah.
things that I want to bring up on this is that prior to the FAFSA laws changing, they had a question on the FAFSA form on what is called untaxed income or support given to the individual student. Well, that question is no longer on the FAFSA. So therefore, if a grandparent were to take funds out of the 529 plan and pays it directly to the college, then that is not looked upon either as untaxed income, nor is it looked upon as an asset of the student. So that was a big, big benefit for individual grandparents, uncles, aunts, neighbors, whoever that has a 529 plan and made the student the beneficiary. So that question is no longer on the FAFSA. So therefore, if $20,000 is disbursed out and next year you complete the free application for federal student aid, it is not counted as an asset of the student, nor is it counted as untaxed income because that question is no longer on the FAFSA.
Now, this is the untaxed income was a big interpretive area of the old FAFSA, and fortunately, with the new simplified FAFSA, they did hold true to their title, and it is no longer there. All the untaxed income sources that made the FAFSA kind of difficult to interpret are gone, and this is one of them. So, I completely agree with you, Chuck. Go ahead, Gary.
I'll just expand a little bit on what Chuck said there, especially when 529 distribution is made from a grandparent's account to the college directly. I normally do not suggest you do that, especially if the student has need-based financial aid. That's going to be considered an outside resource and could possibly reduce the financial aid for that student on a dollar-for-dollar basis. Now, this is not, it's generally accepted, but it's not. So what I'm saying is here, you have to ask a blind question of the college. How do you treat 529 plans that come from a third party? Is it going to reduce our financial aid package? And ask that up front while you're going through your applications for college. That's one of the questions you want to ask the financial aid office. The way to get around that is just what Al said. The distribution is made from the grandparents to the parents. The parents just need to hold on to qualified expenses like tuition bills and book bills and things like that to support this distribution. And it's going to be completely legal to do it that way. The parent can then pay the bills to the school, and there's no reduction in their financial aid. So.
One question I would have for you on that, Gary. Let's assume the grandparent owns the 529 plan and they're planning on disbursing out $20,000 a year to help pay for the kids' education. If they were to take the $20,000 and gift that to the parents, is there a tax consequence to the grandparents by doing that because they're actually not paying for qualified educational expenses?
It could go both ways, okay? And if it is subject gift tax, you would have the $18,000 a year per person exemption on the distribution. But normally, what I've seen is if you have the bills that support the cost of, or support the distribution, then you're going to be safe. I mean, what you've done is you've just put one more person between the parents and the college. And that one person is the parents, and they're submitting the bills on behalf of the student to the grandparent who's making the distribution. So.
Then, in other words, what I'm hearing you say is that if the grandparents were to distribute that out to the individual parents, then the tax-free growth of the 529 plan would not be a tax consequence to the grandparents as long as they have the documentation that the monies was gifted, which goes under the thing laws, to where there is no gift tax, but the gain that is in the 529 plan, that would not neglect that to where it's a taxable consequence to the individual grandparents. Is that true?
That's right. And I'll be a little more conservative here. The distribution is the amount of what the bills are. In other words, if you've got a bill for $22,131 for tuition and fees, and you submit that, the disbursement is $21,231 exactly. You don't want to make it bigger, okay? Because the next question is, well, what did you do with the surplus?
Exactly. Now,
I don't
just
like
as a
529 plans.
well, they are a difference in the this one and the next one that I'm going to mention are really the only really big differences between the assets section of the student. Remember, that's there's two parts to the FAFSA now, the student and the contributing information from the parents. They're not on the same document like they have been in the past. They're two separate sections. So the assets section on the student side doesn't have this, well, it has 529s, but only if you're the owner, the student is the owner. And the other one that's big, well, not big, but it's there more than it's not, is UGMAs and UPMAs. Those are for the student as well as assets of the student. Even if it's a dependent student, it's still an asset of the student.
Now, on that, on the UGMA and UPMA accounts, Al, and maybe Gary can jump in here also, is that if you were to take the assets from the UGMA or UPMA account, you'd have to liquidate them and then throw it into a 529 plan. But my understanding, the IRS laws, is that that student still owns those dollars. So therefore, if it came from an UPMA or an UGMA, then the 529 plan would be owned by the student. Is that correct?
That's what I believe, okay? And I guess the best thing is I would not mix the distribution from an UGMA going into a 529 plan with an existing 529. I'd set up a separate one, and I set it up with the student as the account owner and the student as the beneficiary, and then put the money into that.
So again, the variables are on the sale of the product, and that's the financial planner that made the original sale. Let's jump into, if you own a mortgage, in other words, you're holding the paper on it, that is an asset. So you would list that. Installment and land sales contracts, including mortgages held, is an asset for the parents. Tax shelters is a asset for the parent. Securities is an asset for the parent. And I left the most contentious one for the last. And that's trust. So much fun. So trust are different. Okay. Now it's not the owner beneficiary like the 529, it's the exact opposite. And as far as the baseline starting the discussion on trust, it is who is the owner of the trust and not the beneficiary so much. Okay, so the trust is interesting in that it is to be counted. However, there are people, very, very learned people, and have written books on this, that if that trust is revocable or irrevocable, and these are two titles that you will see in trust all the time, if it's revocable, in other words, here today, possibly gone tomorrow, as the person that is going to take care of that trust, that is something that could be said, well, it doesn't get counted. If it's being going to held up by the courts, there are trusts out there that are actually under the management of the courts. Again, not counted. Outside of those two particular areas that sound pretty obvious, it's going to be counted. And it's not a fun thing to count because sometimes you would sit there and say, wait a minute, we put this money into a trust to benefit to protect this money from being used like this. Well, not according to the Department of Education. I know there's some interesting tidbits here for you two on this one. So Gary, take it away with some trust
I'm not
goodies.
touching this one at all.
I won't get in depth with it either, except for maybe two things. And I think we had mentioned this the last podcast that we put on, is that any cash value that is in a life insurance contract or a tax-deferred annuity is exempt of being claimed as an asset. Now, with that said, what about trust? A lot of trusts may have life insurance proceeds in that trust, as well as maybe tax-deferred annuities. Therefore, if it's in that trust structure, what the colleges or the FAFSA form is wanting is the total value, the total cash value of those funds that are in the trust. So it is my feeling is that if you've got life insurance in a trust and has a cash value in it, and you have an annuity that is tax deferred and is owned by the trust, then you're going to have to count the life insurance cash value as well as the tax deferred annuity as an asset when you put the value of the trust down on the FAFSA form.
Couple of small things on the trust. For family situations, those trusts may not be exclusive to just one person. So again, it sounds pretty obvious, but just want to make a point here, a small point. If there's two or three people in the trust and it's your turn to file the FAFSA, you're going to talk to the trust officer and find out what your value is. In other words, it's going to be easy pickings. It's going to be the value divided by three. Or divided by two, whatever the situation is. So it is going to, you're going to contact the trust officer, whoever that may be, to find out what the current value is and to find out how much of it is yours. Okay.
One
One
last
last
one
thing.
more thing before we move on up the trust. A lot of trusts will prohibit any type of disbursements out until a later date. For example, a grandparent may set up a trust for two grandkids and stipulate within that trust that the proceeds of this trust cannot be distributed out until that individual child is 32 years of age. It doesn't make any difference when it comes to the FAFSA. You're going to have to claim the value of that trust. If you're the beneficiary or owner of that trust, regardless of when the distributions are made.
One
So
last
it's a yes, go ahead, Gary.
I think the most important thing is here, we could get into the weeds there and we'd be on this talk for days, okay? But look at the trust. It's a boring document to read, but read the trust. You have to read it three or four, maybe five times in order you understand it, and then you may still not understand it, but read it, get as much detail in it. If you don't fully understand it, take it to a professional, say, this is what I think it says. Am I right? Yes or no? Spend whatever it's going to cost so you know what it is, especially if the trust is a substantial amount of money.
Again, like I said, there's people who have just written whole books just on this one topic. So here, going back to our little Excel spreadsheet, that is the listing of the items that will go into the investments, so as you calculate all of those different things, if you have them all, then you're going to come up with a total, and that's the total one figure that is put into the FAFSA for the assets under investments. That's just a separate section of the FAFSA. Assets, cash, assets, investments. And next week, we will go into assets from a business and standpoint. So that's it for investments. Now, there is one thing I'm going to put this out there as a kind of a hot potato, really, in that re respect that there are a lot of insurance type related career people. Financial planner type people that sell insurance products and tax deferred products that will use this as an opportunity to make you a family aware of the fact that if you move this money, it is now not going to be counted in the FAFSA formula. This is a true statement. And some people will look at this and say, that's just not right. No, it is right. There's nothing wrong with that particular situation. There may be some differences of opinion on what the value of that policy is for. In other words, am I insuring a risk, or am I just trying to dodge the law? So it should be ethically some kind of a balance between college and retirement. That would be my perspective on it. However, it's not against the law to move money. All right.
Now,
Any
let
last
me.
comments?
Yeah, I do have a comment on that. And here's how a parent, this is normally what I say to an individual parent, is that if you're looking at transferring investments into, let's say, a single premium whole life contract, or transferring the money over to a tax-deferred annuity, to see whether or not shielding those assets is going to increase your availability of free money, not student loans or anything like that. When you calculate your SAI, take the assets out of the picture totally. Don't count them whenever you're estimating what your SAI is. And if you see that you have a potential of qualifying, let's say, for a Pell Grant or an SEOG grant or some type of state grant, then it would be feasible to look at the possibility of switching some of the assets to a life insurance or annuities. But if you're not going to qualify for free money, such as Pell Grants, SEOG grants, as well as state grants, if you're not going to qualify for them and you're not going to benefit of purchasing a life insurance contract, or you are not really interested in an annuity, don't transfer the money.
All right, let's finish this up real quickly with the assets you don't count. Again, remember, you don't count that home. Okay, you don't count the cash and savings and checking accounts, etc., because that is its own separate piece. Don't double count. Don't double count. There's a thing called an ABLE account. It's a tax product. It's a financial product that takes care of special needs. You don't count those. You don't count the life insurance or retirement plans, which we just had a nice little discussion on that. You don't count the UGMA because remember that's going to be on the students. There's a blank for it on the student side, so it's not going to be here on the parent side. Gary, that's it
Okay.
for this week.
We're going to wrap it up here real quick because this is, I think, our longest podcast here, and you're probably still asleep. So, again, this next week, we'll be talking about assets for the business on the FAFSA form. Again, prepare for college, and that's prepare4college.com. Until next week, have a good day. Bye-bye.